Houston Dynamo, Portland Timbers, Sporting Kansas, Los Angeles Galaxy,
Beach Pass,
Toronto FC, Salt Lake,
this is my red, white, and blue.
Chicago Fire,
this is my anthem to you.
Columbus Crew, FC Dallas, York Red Bulls.
Pitch Pass, your all-access credential to the people that matter in MLS. Here's your host, Greg Roach.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Pitch Pass. You know what I'm going to say. I'm going to thank you because you deserve it. Thank you for downloading this episode of the show. And please make sure you are hitting up pitchpass.com. A lot of the conversations that we have, they don't go out of style. We're not talking tactics of the upcoming match. So it's not one of those situations where 3 weeks later, it doesn't make any sense anymore. We've had some great conversations this year with a lot of players, coaches, journalists who cover MLS. And most of them you can download and listen to and still pull some nuggets away even months, weeks down the road. Two great guests lined up for you today. Later on, former headman at DC United, former headman at TFC. Now, he's devoted his attention to youth development and the Players First Initiative. We'll talk to Kevin Payne later on in the show, but first, the hashtag NYIsRed has been sweeping the internet because New York Red Bulls 3-3 against NYCFC in the first series of New York City derbies. One of the main men responsible for that is the head coach of New York Red Bulls. Jesse Marsh joins us right now. Jesse, hello, sir. How are you?
Very good. Been a good day of training. Weather's not too hot. So all in all, it's been a good day.
I was doing some research on you, which is not easy, Jesse. You're a very private man, it seems, as if you've done a good job of keeping yourself off of the internet.
Good. That's good to hear.
And then so I clicked on your Twitter page, and I noticed that I was like, wow, a head coach in MLS has got less than 3,000 followers. That's not a lot. And then I saw your number of tweets, and I was like, oh, okay, this is why people don't follow him.
Yeah, yeah.
I
don't tweet very much. They actually – I'm not a big social media guy. I've never been on Facebook. And when I worked in the MLS digital office, they kept hounding me and telling me that by the end of my time there for the World Cup that they would have a Twitter page for me. So literally the last day before I left, a girl there named Amanda set up my account and basically logged me in and started me on Twitter. So if you're looking for entertainment, then don't follow me.
Well, is it important as a head coach in 2015 to be on social media? Now, that could be a loaded question. I know maybe college coaches, it's probably important, at least for recruiting purposes. But is it important for an MLS coach to be active on social media?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, there's enough. If people want access to, you know, our team and what I have to say about our team, there's enough media outlets that catch me on a daily basis. And that's why I don't really – the only time I really tweet is just to support – what's going on in the organization or what's going on in our front office or what's going on in our academy, just to try and show support for all the different people around here, because it's a really good group of people here at Red Bull and I'm really happy to be involved with it. So that's the only time I really use it now.
I'm not going to claim that I know a ton about your coaching philosophy, the ins and outs of how you do business, but from what I think I know, is the hardest part of this season for you been keeping the spotlight off of you? And I mean that in the sense of how you brought in, the expectations coming in, and then everything going on with heading back to Montreal in the last few weeks, the whole NYC derby going on. Has it been hard to keep the spotlight off of you?
I don't think so. The way that I operate is that I'm always trying to function and think about ways that can make our group better and our team better. So typically that's what I have my mind wrapped around. Typically that's what I talk about publicly or privately. It's just the process at which, you know, we're trying to take this group as far as it can go. So for the most part, I will say that I feel incredibly lucky to be working for this organization, to be working for this team, to be working with these players. Everybody has given everything they've had almost every single day, and it's allowed us to continue the process and be successful at certain moments. And it also allows us in a moment like this to not be satisfied and to feel like we still have a long ways to go and to keep committing ourselves to each other. So, you know, I think that the whole philosophy of now the focus of attention being on the team, that's been easy because I think in many ways that this organization has been hungry for that. These players have been hungry for that. And so it's been a pretty smooth transition in that way.
Well, and a quick follow-up on that, and I don't want to rehash everything that happened preseason and over the offseason, but I do want to ask you, was it difficult for you to, I don't want to say be embraced by the fans, but was it difficult for you knowing what you guys had a mindset, you guys had a game plan of what you wanted to do, knowing that it was also going to be different from what Red Bull fans were used to, having to say to people, be patient, let's see the results, and having to kind of wait for the results to happen, the season to start, before you could say, okay, look, we did have a plan, and this was the plan, and look how it's working.
Well, I think my life would have been made a little bit easier if somebody would have told me not to reference playing like an energy drink. I think that the fans were really upset about that initial comment and were questioning what the heck the new coach was going to bring. But I will say, after that town hall meeting, I think a lot of people at least began to understand who I am and what I'm about and what I'm trying to bring. And then I think, you know, the thing that I tried to promise them was that our team was always going to step on the field and give everything they've had. And they've done that. And you know, our group has gained respect in the way we play and the way we talk and the way we work. And so ultimately, I know that any head coach is going to be judged by how his team plays and what kind of results his team gets. So that's why my focus has been about taking care of that side of things. And along the way, I think that the team's won a lot of fans over, and I think that there's been, you know, I don't know that I'm still considered in the same light as Mike Petke, and I'm not trying to be. Like, I respect what Mike Petke did when he was here. He, you know, he was very successful in many different ways, and he's been a major figure within this club for years, and I have a lot of respect for that. And I'm not trying to be Mike. I'm just trying to do the job the way that I think it needs to be done. And along the way, I hope that people respect the way the team plays.
One of the fascinating things about MLS in 2015 is the different blueprints that can be followed to success. We're going to have Kevin Payne on in the second segment, and he talked at length about the differences in different types of plans. You've got FC Dallas, you've got DC United, you've got the guys that go for the big DPs. You guys are falling kind of somewhere in the middle. Was that the plan that Ali Curtis obviously has been referenced many times? Was that where you wanted to go, and was that one of the attractive things about taking the job?
Well, Ali and I definitely hit it off in our first meeting. And then, you know, when we started to talk about using all of our different experiences and our strengths and weaknesses, we could see that there were a lot of compliments to each other. And, you know, I think I'm a soccer guy, and so I'm the guy that I think thinks about the grassroots, the on-the-field stuff, the massaging and the working with the players, with the team, with the coaches within the organization. Like, that's my strength. And what I lack is any of the kind of organizational experiences and business experiences and ability to, like, from a global perspective now, systematically put things in place in an organized way to make each one of us in all the roles that we take on better and stronger and more connected. And I think Ali brought a lot of that, but he didn't have a lot of the on-the-field experience. So when we started sort of comparing notes and comparing thoughts and ideas, the one thing that we had in common was that we believed that the group was stronger than any individual, that everybody working together would make us, you know, something that would be unique and help us be successful, and the ability to believe in everyone else and engage everybody else was going to be a big measure of our success. And then taking our individual talents and experiences and putting them in place, I think it's allowed us to enjoy the working relationship. It's allowed us to understand each other and make each other better and help each other grow. So, you know, Ali is, we're different. We're different in a lot of different ways, but we're very similar in terms of really working with each other and challenging each other.
How deep into the Red Bull system do you go? And by that, I mean, are you sharing tactics with the academy down to the U12 level, or is that Curtis's job and you're just implementing in the first team?
No, he's allowed me, you know, I told him early on that I enjoy the coaching community part of any club. You know, and when I came here, when you see all the resources and the facilities and the people, you see that it's an opportunity to do things right and really engage everyone in a way that makes them feel part of it. And a big part of that for me is getting the academy right. And, you know, even when I was with the U.S. national team, I was the first assistant coach ever in the U.S. national team to go down and work with the youth teams. And, you know, in my time with U.S. soccer, I worked with the U14s, the U15s, the U17s, the U18s, the U20s, and the U23s. And so I would work with the coaches there. I would work with the players. And I was trying to help connect the dots between what was happening with Bob Bradley's team and what was happening with all the youth teams. And so, you know, we tried to implement some of that in Montreal, but there were a lot of different challenges that made it very difficult to achieve. But here, everything is kind of under one roof. And so, and there's really good people, some of which I've had relationships with in the past, and we have really integrated our training methods, our tactics, our philosophies, our mentalities, all the way from the U12s all the way up. And, you know, we're even in the process of putting together our curriculum that will include everything from what our leadership style is to what our mentality is to what our training methods to our tactics at different levels to what we're looking for, you know, almost like a graduating system, like what kind of things we want our 12s to be efficient with, our 13s, our 15s, our, you know, 16s, 18s, USL Pro, all the way up to the first team. We're connecting the dots in every way to make sure that everybody's aligned and everybody's on the same page. So, and as much as it's been fun working with the first team and trying to get all the details of our team right, the part of working with the academy and the academy coaches, I think, has been equally as fun, equally as challenging, and equally as rewarding.
And I think that's a lesson is the knee-jerk reaction. And I know I had the same reaction as an outsider, not a Red Bulls fan, but as a fan of MLS. You looked at the offseason and thought to yourself, okay, Red Bulls are tightening the belts, and they lost Henri. They're not replacing him with another designated player of that magnitude. This must be them clamping down. When you don't think about peeling that layer away and you think of all of the resources that Red Bulls were still supplying to your academy, to obviously the stadium and everything involved in that, and then at the halfway point of the season, seeing the reinforcements that you guys were able to bring in, it showed, at least to non-Red Bulls fans, oh, okay, they're not tightening the belt straps, they're just being smarter about where they're putting their money.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you are on the outside, you would say that, you know, there's a lot of cuts because of the player pool and the player salary pool, right? And that is true. I'm not gonna deny that. That is true. I mean, we are being fiscally more responsible, and we're changing the philosophy of how we play, and then what kind of players we bring in. But when you talk to people that have been in Red Bull for 8 years, they've never seen Salzburg and Leipzig open their scouting networks, open their coaching networks, opening their player pool networks, you know, their medical networks, all these different things. You know, the amount of trips that Ali Curtis has taken over to over there to learn about what they're doing and the resources that they've shared. And so, you know, they're really trying to connect the dots with what's happening, you know, with what's happening here as well. And I'll tell you, you know, that the word we get right now is that Mr. Matuschitz in Austria is his most proud project that he has right now is the New York Red Bulls. And he tells people all across his different business platforms about the work that's being done here, the philosophy, how things are being put in place. And I think that now there's a real attachment. So in such a way that, you know, maybe they're not throwing the monies at the DP players as much anymore, but they're committing more resources to the foundation of what this club will be for the future. And, you know, that right now we're building over here at the training facility, we're building more fields. They're building another facility for the academy. So there's a lot of money that's being put into this that's going to grow. And a lot of that has to do with Ali's, you know, quote unquote, 300-page business plan, is that he is now putting an infrastructure in place for this club to grow and become so much more of a well-rounded organization and a machine that looks like something that's very professional and organized and clean. And again, that for me, that's something that I find that will be very beneficial for me and the job that I'm doing and ultimately how our first team performs.
You've mentioned the other Red Bull teams in Europe. A lot has been made about your friend across the river, Jason Kreis, and his sojourns to Manchester to learn. And it's been made, I don't want to say it's a big deal, but it's been publicized. You've taken trips over as well to talk with the other Red Bull teams. Have you picked up anything from the European clubs as far as helping grow you as a coach?
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing is that there's a man named Ralf Rangnick that is the sporting director of all of Red Bull football. He currently has been named the Leipzig coach as well. So he has another gentleman that works with him named Helmut Grosch. And those two are kind of the soccer minds behind the overall philosophy of what's trying to get done at Red Bull and sharing different ideas and thoughts and tactics and everything else. And, you know, they're very bright football minds. And the ability to sit down and talk with them, to hear what they think is important, to hear how they implement things, to hear, you know, what's been done and what's been successful at their different levels, I think has helped me a lot as a coach. Now, they've also given me a lot of freedom to take this and say, you know, it's my team and it's our group, and that Ollie and I should kind of take information of things that they've been successful with and now apply it and run with it. And they've really, I think, backed us and believed in us. And you know, we check in with everything that's going on over there and some of the people that are there on a weekly basis. And it's been really a great relationship. It's just, you know what, it's been so nice to be somewhere where you feel like everybody's pulling in the right in the same direction. And everybody believes in each other and everybody supports each other. And it trickles down to our organization and it trickles down to our staff and to our players. They feel it, they see it, and they carry it out on the field. And I think that's one thing that's been an identity of ours from day one since I've been here is it feels like a real team. And those guys, when they step on the field, they play for each other, they're committed to each other, and we ask that they do that every day in training as well.
How much of that on-pitch pulling together comes down to your captain?
Yeah, I think a lot of it does. I think Dax has been an integral part of how this team's come together and taking his experiences of, you know, this club in the past and now applying them to what we're trying to become in the future. And he has helped. You know, we have the leadership council full of 8 guys on the team, and so I've invested in the relationships that I have with the experienced and the older veteran guys, and I've asked and demanded them to take a big role into who we become and to not just for this not to just be a representation of me, but for it to be a representation of all of us and what we all believe in and things that have made us all successful in all the places we've been, but then put it into a unique identity that's, I think, true to who we are, and then something that the players, you know, take ownership on and carry with them when they step on the field. Because ultimately, that's where it's got to show up. That's where it's got to matter. Is when they step on the field, it's got to be real. They've got to understand how to play for each other and give everything they have to the common purpose. And I can't, you know, if I were to give the area that I would give the players the most credit is that they've done that in a really good job, and it's helped us, I think, be successful along the way.
I've talked to Dax a few times this season. Obviously, players, coaches like yourself, in season, it's going to be we just want to focus on the next game, and I understand that rhetoric. However, you are a man of few tweets, as we have established at the top of the conversation. You did tweet though. Hashtag NY is red. So now that the 3 matches are behind you, and you've seen people tried to poo-poo the rivalry as maybe something MLS wanted to manufacture, but now that you've seen it, and especially this past weekend, it was just, you know, as a fan of neither team, it was amazing seeing the scenes at Red Bull Arena. What is that rivalry mean to New York now and to the Red Bulls?
Yeah, I mean, I referenced it in the post-game press conference that I'm not a New Yorker, but I went to college in New Jersey. I've been around this area for many years. I've obviously been in the league for many years, and I've never seen New York so alive with football. And people taking sides and the whole New York is red, New York is blue, and what it means, and now people attaching themselves to the identity of one club or the other. And, you know, I think that this league has been missing that. And we've been missing – New York is a big city, and it's – in many ways, the center of what happens in this country. And for, I think, finally to see, you know, local teams, local football, like domestic football, take off and really thrive in New York City, I think it's a game changer for our league. Certainly, we take a lot of pride in now those 3 games and winning those 3 games. But, you know, we're respectful of what they're trying to achieve at New York City FC. I think that there's good people over there. I know how hard it is to be an expansion team. So, we're proud of the fact that we were able to get 3 wins in this year, but we know that next year the games will be even more heated. And, you know, there's little storylines and underneath, battles that are incorporated into this series and relationships and everything else. But that's what a derby needs. Is it's starting to develop that on-field hatred that's important for all big games. And so, you know, like I said, the reality is that we respect who they are and what they're doing, but we're adamant about what we're doing here, and we want to make sure that when we step on the field against them that it shows up.
You're putting a good, fun product on the field. Is there anything that you guys can do on the team level to keep that going? You've got TFC coming to town on Friday. That's a huge match. I assume their designated players will bring in fans. Is there anything that you guys can do to continue this momentum outside of the derby matches?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've just got to understand that, you know, that it was a big moment and we should all feel good, but we're not done. You know, the ultimate goal is still, you know, a long ways away. And I give credit to our guys. And the thing I've been saying to them lately is keep our foot on the gas pedal, because we still know that as good as we've been in certain moments this season, that we can be so much better. And we have so much more to give, and we can, there's a lot of room for growth. You know, that along with getting a couple guys healthy and getting our team fully back on track and having all the resources we have now operating and thriving and pushing all the way. I mean, our team has become deep. It's talented. It's young. It's explosive. So, you know, I think that we've become a pretty well-rounded team, and I expect us to make a good push here down the stretch.
And to me, the exciting thing, not just about those three matches, but, you know, the playoffs are a whole different animal. And I'm talking about atmosphere and crowd interaction specifically. They're a whole different animal, but it was rare in the early days of MLS for matches to have these big game feels in the middle of the regular season. Now you've got these rivalry matches. Not just with NYCFC, but you and the Union have been going at it. Obviously, DC United and the Red Bulls have had a rivalry. Yeah. It's not a situation where, okay, these mid-season matches are just kind of going through the motion, paint by numbers. There's huge crowds, huge atmosphere, and it feels like there's a lot more on the line than just 3 points in the middle of the season.
I totally agree, and I think you'd have to throw New England in there.
Absolutely.
And what those games have been like, and even Colorado. Those have been really good soccer, like, those two games have been two of our best, like, high-level soccer games of the year. So, you know, I said from the beginning that I know from being in LA and Chivas that those games are different. They're special, right? And they're games that other teams in the league don't have. And so the emotion, the weight of the experience, the weight of the match, the crowds, like, it makes your team better. Whether you win or lose those games, it makes your team better. And so now having gone through some of the other matchups with close, heated, emotional rivals in our division, that's going to make us better in the long run. And hopefully come playoff time, that atmosphere and that won't be strange to us. We'll know what it's like. We've been there before, and we'll know how to behave.
It's been very, very fun to watch the evolution of New York Red Bulls into this incarnation, which feels like it's got long-term roots now rather than just trying to throw money and putting players on the field. And a lot of it comes down to you and, obviously, Ali. So, Jesse March, you've got a follower on Twitter in me, so you've got one more follower.
Awesome. Awesome.
And I thank you very much.
I think I'm up to 2001.
There you go. There you go. Thank you, Coach. I appreciate the time.
Thank you very much. Take care.
If you haven't been watching Red Bull matches because you don't think they have enough star power for you to watch, you're doing yourself a disservice. They are one of the more exciting teams in MLS to watch. And I still feel like they're on the come up, which is a little scary as a DC United fan and being chased by Red Bulls. Part of the big reason we just mentioned, Coach Jesse March. Thank you very much to him for giving us some time. I alluded to our second guest. Spoiler alert, this is a recorded conversation in a podcast. So settle in for a really, really interesting conversation about youth development, about the old days of MLS or the early days of MLS with a man who has been there literally from the start. Now he is one of the main, now he's devoted his attention to youth development and the Players First Initiative, which if you don't know about, this is a perfect conversation for you to listen to. Kevin Payne joins us now on the show. Kevin, hello, sir. How are you?
Very good. I'm doing very well. Thank you very much for having me.
I think we should start with what you're up to, because at least for me, I'm living and working in Washington, D.C., a city I think you're a little bit familiar with, I guess. Yes.
Yeah, yes, indeed.
And, you know, a lot of stuff has been in the news as far as DC United's academy is concerned, and it kind of ties in nicely with what you are up to these days. So if you could, let's start there and talk about Players First and what it is.
So Players First is a philosophy that we are asking clubs to adopt to present a holistic experience for players and parents in youth soccer, which is based on the principle that the club seeks to provide an environment in which every player can reach their full potential. And there's a lot more to it, obviously, than that. But that's the most basic level of what the Players First initiative is about. And we're trying, by creating a branded youth soccer experience, we're trying to provide parents with a sort of shorthand way of understanding what they can expect from a Players First club so that they know what to look for. We're also, a big part of this is aimed at trying to educate parents about what is the right kind of experience for their child. Today, most parents don't really know how to measure the value of the club that they're, or any club that they're looking to put their kids into. And they, too often, they end up just relying on wins and losses. And the overemphasis on winning, and particularly the sort of win-at-all-costs mentality, has had a terrible, terrible impact on the game in our country. It has retarded the development of our most talented players, and it has caused our sport to suffer a 70 to 75% attrition rate by the age of 12 or 13. So what we're trying to do is change that environment, change the culture of youth soccer, make it much more nurturing, much more holistic in the way it looks at the experience that the child has, and at the same time provide parents in effect, a good housekeeping seal of approval.
You hit on something that strikes home with me. I'm the parent of a 7-year-old who was just kind of embarking on his soccer journey. And, you know, you don't know if he's good enough to play, move from rec to select. But then when you try to figure out whether he's good enough through internet research, there is no, as you call it, a seal of approval. And it's just, oh, okay, is this guy just taking my money, or is my kid good enough to play on his team? I don't know. And it goes back to what you said about wins and losses and really that making the difference. And so for me as a parent, this is something that I would find extremely valuable, especially as a parent who doesn't know the sport or the ins and outs of the leagues in his area.
Yeah, I mean, what we hope is that, and look, this is going to take some time
to
really establish. Obviously, it's a very ambitious project, but we hope that, you know, if you were asking this question a year from now or 2 years or 3 years from now, you would be able to answer your own question by saying, if I find a club that is a certified Players First club, I know that no matter what level my kid is at a given moment, he's going to get the same kind of attention and he's still going to be nurtured and the club is going to encourage him to get better. And if it turns out that he develops, I don't know if it's he or she, develops well enough physically and has enough focus on soccer that they want to move forward and play at a, you know, an increasingly competitive level, then you want the club to move them forward at the rate that's appropriate for them. And if all they want to do is have fun with their friends and play a fun game, because let's face it, it's supposed to be fun.
Yep.
Then you want the club to embrace that too. And unfortunately, that's not what happens too often. Today, too many clubs are really only interested in the kids that they think can help them win. And it's, you know, they want to know about the kids that can help them win youth soccer games. You know, in the grand scheme of player development, who really cares about who's winning youth soccer games? They certainly aren't. They don't care in Spain. You know, they're not worried about, Barcelona's not worried if their U-12 team is winning every game. In fact, they probably are worried if they're winning every game because they probably assume that they're not doing the things they're supposed to be doing to develop for later. you know, this is it really is a process, and that's what we're trying to put into effect. I mentioned this weekend that part of what really drove, I've been looking at this idea and thinking about this idea for 7 or 8 years in my role as the chairman of the U.S. Soccer Technical Committee, and in particular, when we had a very active player development task force on the boys' side. That's really the working group that developed the academy concept. In one of our meetings, we were discussing Zone 1, which is under 12. And there was a woman sitting across the table from me who was talking about the fact that she had just moved to a new community. And she really had no idea how to figure out the right club for her children, who were young. They were, you know, 5 or 6.
Yeah.
And that woman was Mia Hamm. So if Mia Hamm isn't sure how to tell from the outside whether this is the club that's right for her kids or not, and she has a pretty good idea that what she's looking for is for her kids to be nurtured and have a fun environment, not to be driven, then, you know, what chance does a normal person have from the outside? So that's, that always has been the concept. I've been talking with people about this for years and how to develop this. It just happens that the fact that U.S. club soccer is organized by clubs, that really is the best way to try to implement something like this. You can't implement it at too large a level, and you can't, and it's, and it doesn't really work at the team, individual team level. I mean, the team may end up adopting these principles, but you actually need resources to do this properly. So that's why we think that we have a chance to do this, where maybe some other organizations that, you know, are well-meaning and recognize the need for change, it might be harder for them just simply because of the way we're organized.
You know, you took the Mia Hamm story is amazing. And I was going to say, you know, let's say that young Lucas, your grandson, who I hear is a phenomenal soccer player already at 2.5, didn't have a well-connected grandfather. Is this the place where he would go? And would you have it in place by the time he is ready to play rec? But you're telling me it doesn't matter what connections you have. You still may not know.
No. And
is Lucas a phenomenal player, by the way?
I will also no. He's a very enthusiastic player. I am certainly not at the age of 2.5 going to say he's a phenomenal player. I think every grandparent probably thinks that their grandchild is a phenomenal player. He enjoys the game a great deal. Lucas is very lucky. His father and his father's family are from Ecuador. My family is obviously embedded in the game.
Yes.
And he spends a lot of time around a player who's currently playing and starring for DC United. So he has he doesn't have a normal level of exposure to the game, but he's very, very enthusiastic about it. But, and what I would like, you know, I hope that he'll turn into a good enough player and a good enough athlete that he can play at a high level. But if all he ends up wanting to do is play at a recreational level, I want to make sure that he can enjoy that. And that he doesn't get driven out of the game because there's so much emphasis placed on results, on outcomes. It's just, you know, we had a phenomenal keynote speaker this weekend named Dr. Colleen Hacker. Dr. Hacker was herself a coach of women's soccer at the university Division I level for 17 years. She is a clinical psychologist. She's worked with the women's national team since 1999, and she has worked with the last 5 Olympic teams. So she knows a little something about performance and achieving high level performance. And she would tell you that if you look at the typical experience at a youth soccer club today, with the tremendous emphasis and pressure on outcomes instead of process, it literally is exactly the wrong way to develop young athletes. It's absolutely counterintuitive and it does not work. And these are facts. There's an enormous amount of research that's been done on this, and it's not really open to debate. Yet we continue to move along really in the wrong direction and down the wrong path. And what we're trying to do is get, you know, a certain number of clubs initially to be the pioneers, the brave ones, and say, we're going to do things differently. And then we want to try to convince parents that actually that different way is the better way, so that that can become a competitive advantage in the marketplace. Because you can't talk about youth soccer in the United States without recognizing that it is an enormous business. And it's not going to change. And to pretend that you can just adopt the European model is absolutely naive.
I want to continue discussing youth and youth soccer, but I want to focus it on my club, which is DC United. It came out recently that they are, I don't know if they're the only one or one of the few MLS clubs remaining that still operate on a pay-to-play basis. How important is it for clubs like DC United, and I'm talking about MLS franchises at this point, to do away with the pay-for-play and adopt more of a, you come in and play, and I don't care what your financial status is, we need to develop you as a player?
Well, I think it's really important that, you know, one of the problems in our sport, and I've been in it a long, long, long time, one of the problems in our sport is that we continually look for the sort of, I call it the eureka moment. We think that we're going to discover one thing that we're doing wrong, and that's going to change everything. And we have to understand better that it requires a lot of change. And the change has to happen within the context of American soccer. So pay-to-play is the new bugaboo. I would say at the professional academy level, it is a better model not to charge kids. But DC United has to make their own business decision based on where they are at this moment. You know, they're trying to figure out how to pay for a very expensive stadium. And at some point, I'm sure that they intend to go to a model in which they're not charging kids to play. But that's different from, you know, there are 20 MLS clubs in America, and there's another 60, roughly, academy teams in America. And then there are, I don't even know what the number is, maybe 10,000 other clubs in America. Those clubs don't have the same agenda that DC United has, and they don't have the same resources. So they have, somebody has to pay for this. Let me just put it into perspective for you. I believe, and I'm not an economist, and I may be low on this because many people calculate the number much higher, but I think that just in terms of what is spent with clubs and with other instruction by players and their families, of the different organizations, the three primary organizations that are part of U.S. soccer, USYSA, AYSO, and U.S. Club Soccer, my organization, I think that families are probably spending somewhere between $4 and $5 billion a year. Now, that's more than 10 times the total revenue of MLS in a year. That's more than that's double the National Hockey League in a year. That's more than La Liga. That's more than the Bundesliga. That's an enormous business. And to pretend that somehow that is going to just go away, it's just silly. That's not going to happen. So what the answer is, let's try to find ways to make the experience that people are paying for better. Not pretend that somehow we're going to not have kids paying to play. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that there are a lot of opportunities for kids from more modest means who have promise. There are a lot of opportunities for those kids to play without having to pay, or at least without having to pay the full amount. So I know that DC United has been getting criticized, but they have to make decisions in the context of what's happening with their business right now.
Well, you would the argument, I think, from an outsider's and as a fan's point of view is, yeah, they have to pay for the stadium, but if you're telling me they have to cut costs in the academy to go bare bones to pay for a stadium, that concerns me about the financials of the people paying for the stadium. To which then I would ask you a question, and you may not know the answer to this off the top of your head, but for a player like Eddie Nahar, what do you think United's yearly investment in him as a youth before he makes the first team is as he is coming up? And then what times how many players are in the United Academy at this point?
Well, that obviously, and I'm not gonna offer my opinions about that. It wouldn't be appropriate because I'm not just a fan. if I say things about this on this subject, it's gonna carry a little more weight.
But the cost is significant, though. Correct for each player. There is a cost involved in investing in this player. There is a cost.
Of course, there is. There's a cost involved in maintaining the infrastructure of the academy and paying the instructors and so forth and so on, the travel, everything else. I think it's likely that if you did some sort of calculation and based largely on Andy, you'd have to impute some value to Bill Hamid or Ethan White or some of the other guys who came to the team and weren't sold. Michael Seaton was sold within MLS.
Yeah.
So, you know, the team has gotten value from Michael Seaton. You know, I think the DC Academy over the years is in the black, but on a cash flow basis at a given point in time, that may not be the critical consideration. I can't speak to, and I'm not going to criticize, nor am I going to defend DC United's decision because it's not my responsibility. I don't run the team anymore. And the people that are running the team have made a decision. I'm sure it wasn't, you know, a frivolous decision. They had reasons for it.
Let me ask you a philosophical question. Would you rather have 10 Andy Nahars, and by that I mean homegrown at the salary that they're making with the skill level that they have, or would you rather have one designated player on the skill level and salary that they have? And which one is better, do you think, for MLS as it stands today, as the league is set up today?
Yeah, you know, I was much more of a development guy than a DP guy, and maybe that was because we never really had the resources to spend a lot of money on DPs. So we were focused more on, you know, how could we either develop young talent or how could we acquire talent and put it together in a way, as Ben and Dave have done this year, in a way that where the whole is much greater than the sum of the parts. So I don't think there's a straight up and down answer to that question. And I'm not trying to dodge it.
Yeah.
You know, if I was running Man City or, New York City FC, I'd probably have a different opinion than I would have maybe at DC United. But right now, DC United is a better team than New York City FC and will be a better team all year long and will finish 20 to 25 points ahead of New York City FC at the end of this year. And that's, you know, I can say that with absolute, you know, conviction. So you can draw your own conclusions from that.
Yeah.
The history of big money DPs in this league has been mixed. I was talking with Clark Hunt at MLS Cup and congratulating him on the commitment that they've shown in Dallas to focus really on developing their own talent. And they've done a great job of it. Now, to be fair, they have a perfect situation, which DC United does not have. They have a very large complex of fields that surrounds their stadium that they control. And so it made perfect sense for them to create a very large club, in effect, around FC Dallas. And the best players that come through that system have been fed into FC Dallas. And it's working very well for them. They're very committed to that philosophy. They still have brought in some players from the outside that are very, very important players. Mauro Diaz, for instance. They're not the same player without him on the field. But that's, I think, in many ways, that certainly is the way, you know, if somebody said to me, you can do it however you want, that's more the way I would want to do it, where we develop, let's say, 80% of the players on the team, and then we found that the 20% that put us over the top.
Well, and you were never about names, and I thought of this as I knew that we were going to talk, and people talk about now how DC United is they have no names, they're kind of boring or whatever. That's the way the team's always been built. While Metro Stars were bringing in the Roberto Donadonis of the world, you were bringing in Marco Echeverri, who, you know, was a great player and was maybe a known name. But he wasn't Roberto Donadoni. He was just a guy that from Bolivia that you guys brought in and made a part of a huge puzzle that ended up, as you said about this year's club, being better than the sum is better than the, or the whole was better than the sum of the parts.
Well, you know, I would not minimize Marco.
I wouldn't Marco, either. But when an outside fan
I'm not,
is looking.
No, I'm not even talking about his playing. But, you know, Marco was a very well-known player. Marco was the two-time runner-up player of the year in South America. He had led Bolivia to beating, scored the goal to beat Brazil for the first time ever in World Cup qualifying. And Marco had played in Spain as a very young player. So he was well-known. He wasn't as well-known as Roberto Donadoni. I think from my point of view, the one thing that I always wanted to do and that Dave and I did together, and I think Dave is probably still doing this, we tended to look south,
yes,
not east. You know, there are great players in Europe, but you have to pay European prices to get them. And, you know, right now, there's a number of guys that have been brought in for huge amounts of money from Europe, and some of them are really paying dividends. Obviously, Jovinko has been fantastic. Kaká, who, you know, came from Europe, but he's obviously Brazilian, has been fantastic. David Villa has been fantastic. Jury's out on what's going to happen with, you know, Pirlo and Lampard and, you know, even Gerrard. I mean, Gerrard, LA's looked good in some games at home since he got there. Not so good on the road. Not so good in the heat of Houston. And it wasn't even a hot night. So there's a lot of, you know, people want to draw early conclusions on all this stuff. And maybe because I was around so long, I always tried to caution to have a little bit longer view on this and a little better perspective. I heard somebody on a television show the other night that Steve Nichol was on, and they were saying, oh, is Jovinko the best player in the history of MLS? And he started laughing and said, you know, what about Carlos Valderrama? What about Marco Echeverri? What about Jaime Moreno? Why don't you slow down? Let's see if he wins a championship. You know, that's not to say he's not a great player, but my goodness, let's not anoint him the best player in the history of the league just yet.
After half of a season.
Right. So I would say this year is really, you know, a pretty good microcosm of the long-term experience we've had with expensive players, particularly expensive players in Europe. Some work out great. Some do a reasonable job. And some, it just doesn't really work. And, you know, it's horses for courses. This league is much more complicated and much harder than people think it is. Is the quality as uniformly high as it is in, you know, the top European leagues? No, but that doesn't mean it's easier.
I'm giving you the keys to a franchise. Are you choosing to bring in Los Angeles Galaxy's DPs or NYCFC's DPs to start?
Well, I think that, you know, Andrea Pirlo in particular is one of my favorite players. ever, probably. And I've been a great admirer of Frank Lampard, and I love David Villa. David Villa is closer to the L.A. model.
Yes.
Now, L.A. is just going in a completely different direction with Giovanni Dos Santos, who's still only, 26 or something, 27? When they got Robbie Keane, I think he was 32. Steven Gerrard's 33. You know, he's 33 with a lot of miles on him, so, you know, the jury's out. But I think Steven Gerrard's going to end up being a very impactful player in the league. And I would certainly be more inclined to go the way L.A. has gone as opposed to the way New York has gone. I think it's very challenging to have two guys in the midfield who are 37 and 38,
yes,
something like that. And neither one of whom was ever a gifted athlete. They both had phenomenal qualities, but covering ground was not one of them. So if you pair them together, that's going to be a challenge. I think that New York City FC's got their work cut out for them. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, of course.
Claudio Reyna's a pretty smart guy, and Jason Kreis is a pretty smart guy. And they may have a different vision for how they're going to play, and it may take them a little time to get there.
For people who may not remember or may not have been following the league at the time, I thought you would say the LA Galaxy's DPs, which goes into Thomas Floyd, who you know and I know, he is a reporter in the D.C. area, speculated that the 2015 LA Galaxy starting lineup may be the best MLS 11. Again, I know what you're going to say is it's hard to say that after X amount of time. My source tells me that you might argue that the 98 D.C. United team would be also in that conversation, if not ahead of them. So if you could, for us new people to MLS, make the case for the 98 United squad as one of the best MLS starting 11s ever.
Well, every field player on that team was a full international. Most of them started for their national teams. The only position in which the player wasn't at least semi-regular starter was in goal. And maybe you could argue Richie Williams. But the rest of the team, Jeff Agus, Eddie Pope, Carlos Llamosa, John Harkes, Tony Sanna, Ben Olsen, Jaime Moreno, Roy Lassiter, Marco Echeverry, I would put that team, and I think Bruce would put that team on the field against anybody. It's a fun argument, but
yes,
but a pointless argument about whether it's better, than some LA. I'll tell you this. Recent teams, I'm not going to single any out, but recent teams that have won the MLS Cup would have had trouble getting, in my opinion, very many of their starters on the field for that DC United team.
Well, and a quick follow-up to that is what would be the mindset or the tactical mindset for a team facing that United team? If you were LA Galaxy, where would we attack? Where would we feel like, okay, we can exploit this weakness or this weakness?
Yeah, I'll tell you this. I'd like to have either one of the teams if Bruce was my coach.
So for you, can we say he's the all-time best MLS coach?
Oh, without question.
Okay.
It's not even close. He's the all-time best American coach, without question. Anybody that wants to argue about that is delusional. He has had more success, more consistently at every level that he has coached than anybody. And it's not even really close. So, no, I don't think, and that's no disrespect intended. We've had some other terrific coaches in the league. Bob Bradley.
Exactly.
Ziggy Schmid, Dominic Kinnear, now Peter Vermees. You know, these are very good coaches, guys that have done a great job, but just not, not at the same level as Bruce.
Two quick things, and I'll let you go, and I thank you in advance for your time. The first one would be the United Stadium deal. What are your personal thoughts on seeing this journey that you laid so much for the groundwork for, that you kind of slaved and toiled over? We see the light at the end of the tunnel, and the journey is coming to an end. Is it for you kind of fulfilling? Is it bittersweet? What is your mindset as you see a United Stadium about to start being built?
Oh, it's not bittersweet at all. It's very fulfilling. I hope, and I'm not very close to it. Now I don't even live in DC, so I don't even hear quite as much about it. But I trust that the light at the end of the tunnel is not an oncoming train. but assuming that they're able to move forward and fully ratify everything that they need to with the city, and get the land acquisition completed, and then actually begin to build. It will be a remarkable moment in the history of MLS and the history of DC United. And if I played a role in that, then I will be very proud of that. I think the fans of DC United are the equal, certainly at the least, the equal of any market in the country. And they were fans 20 years ago, where a lot of the cities that are now patting themselves on the back didn't even know what a soccer ball was. So the whole club, fan club culture really started with DC United and the Eagles and the Barra, and later the La Norte, and now the Ultras. And they deserve a stadium. Will Chang deserves a stadium. He's put a tremendous amount of money, but also emotional capital, into keeping this team alive. And, people don't understand how hard it was in 2008 and 2009. And, it would have been very easy and probably prudent for Will to have just walked away. Lots of people walked away from lots of businesses at that time, and he didn't. I hope I'm invited to the opening of the stadium. And if I am, I'm sure I'll have tears in my eyes, and there won't be anything bittersweet about it at all. I'll be immensely proud of DC United from top to bottom. I am immensely proud right now of the job that Dave and Ben and Chad Ashton and Amos McGee and everybody else are doing. They've built a really resilient team that continues to get results. The fans can talk about whatever they want to talk about it being, I don't know how anybody could call it boring after the last few weeks, but
true.
It's a very well-balanced team, and it has tremendous character and tremendous self-belief. And they're going to be a good team right through the end of the season. They're going to be a dangerous team in the playoffs. And they're built. It's a different model. Dave has found a way to create really a new model. I was talking about this with people out at the MLS Cup. This is actually when we created the concept of the designated player. Part of the thinking was that because it's a relatively closed system, as long as we got the cap charge right for the DPs, the DP eating up that amount of the salary cap would force other good players onto the open market. And it would give those teams that maybe didn't want to spend that kind of money the opportunity to pick up better MLS talent. And I think that's exactly what's happened now with DC United. They don't have, big, expensive brand name DPs. But if you look at the quality of their players, 1 through, say, 15, it's higher than many of the other teams in the league. And when they get guys, that when Chris Pontius comes back and when Michael Farfan comes back, it's going to be very, you know, you're going to have really good players not starting. And if you look at the teams that have three expensive or now four DPs, in many cases, the guys that are, you know, numbers 12, 13, 14, 15, they don't really want to see those guys on the field very much.
If you could,
United can go, you know, when they're healthy in particular, they can go 16, 17 deep. You know, this young player, Opari, in the back, he's a terrific back. And, you know, he can't get a game right now.
Yeah.
So I think it's really fascinating. You've got different models at work. Dallas has a model that's based largely on homegrown players. DC has a model that's based on a little bit on homegrown players, but more on bringing in veteran talent from other MLS teams. And then you've got, you know, LA or Toronto or, you know, different teams that have built more with, you know, expensive DPs and then trying to fill in around them. And it's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out.
Speaking of Toronto, in one word, would you be able to describe your time in Toronto?
Disappointing.
Okay. Last thing, you were one of the stars of Brian Strauss's piece, which was the oral history of the launching of MLS. Was there anything when you read, if you did read it, was there anything that you didn't know from what other people had said while you were reading, or was all of it kind of like, yeah, okay, I remember that?
No, I was right there in the middle of it. So
yeah.
there weren't a lot of surprises for me. I mean, you know, Mark Abbott and I have laughed over the years many, many times about the famous Ferrari story with Jorge Campos. Clark and I, you know, we were both at the very first meeting, and until I left Toronto, I had never missed a Board of Governors meeting in basically 20 years. So, you know, there was a lot of things that that happened back then, and it was an unbelievable experience for those of us who got to live it. I really appreciated Brian doing such a good job. The one thing I will say, and I'm trying to remember where I saw this. I saw somebody, I want to say it was, I think it was a writer for the Post who sort of took out of context the conversation about how the team name came to be. And the point I was trying to make to Brian was that the first time somebody said it, it was said in sort of sarcastically by an employee of ours in New York who really didn't even like soccer. But that's not why we adopted the name. You know, he said it and we all looked at each other. And the more we thought about it, the more we talked about it, the more we said, this is a name that really makes sense. I'm a student of history. I'm a student of change in communities and cities. And I knew what was happening in D.C. in terms of the divisions that were being exacerbated, geographic, socioeconomic, racial. And we thought the idea of being looked at as a unifying force was a very powerful message. So to us, that was why we ultimately named ourselves DC United. We weren't trying to imitate Manchester United, just as they weren't trying to imitate, you know, they weren't the first United in England. For us, the name spoke to a very powerful impulse that we had, that our club could bring together people from different backgrounds who otherwise would never come in contact with each other. And that happened. That's exactly what happened. So, you know, I'm proud of the name. You know, we knew that we weren't going to own it exclusively forever, that other people would adopt it. But, I do think people should know that there was a lot more thought that went into why we took that name than simply one casual conversation in a lunchroom.
Kevin Payne, thank you very much for the time. Players first, it seems like just a slam dunk initiative that we need to implement in this country. So I wish you the best of luck with that. And thank you very much for spending some time with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Pass.
This is your voice. This is my red, white, and blue. This is my.
For show information, go to pitchpass.com.